Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Bruce Fine, the legal counsel for Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father, and discuss the open letter they have written to the young American fugitive who is the subject of a worldwide manhunt. Bruce Fine is the author of American Empire Before the Fall and was a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign. Then we'll speak with Frank Snepp, a former CIA officer and whistleblower whose book, A Decent Interval, became the basis of the landmark Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Snepp, that defines the legal rights and risks of U.S. intelligence employees who become whistleblowers. We will examine the Snowden case with someone who has had the Supreme Court throw the book at them and discuss Frank Snepp's article at CNN, Snowden and a Muzzled Free Press. Then finally, with the majority of public sentiment firmly against the recent overturning of the Voting Rights Act, we will look into the role of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, as the leading strategist for the Republican Party, as some have charged. Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, joins us to discuss his article on the Roberts Court in Monday's New York Times, Justice for Big Business. Before we begin, of course, the breaking story at the moment is the military coup in Egypt. It was hardly a surprise. The military gave Morsi, the president of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, 48 hours to get his act together and to bring together the factions, particularly in this very divided country. Instead, Morsi, of course, has proclaimed that he's ready to for martyrdom and to shed blood for Egypt and all this nonsense. And half the population, of course, is now they're all celebrating in Tahrir Square, letting off fireworks. A petition of 22 million Egyptians want to get rid of this guy. So, normally, military coups indicate a setback for democracy, but we'll wait and see whether this, in fact, is a different in the sense that maybe they'll have a chance to get it right a second time around, given that the head of the country now is the head of the Supreme Court, and they've called for very quick elections and to scrap the Islamic constitution. So we will see. Let's now go to the counsel for Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father. Joining us now is Bruce Fine, a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and is currently legal counsel for Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father. He has just written an open letter to Edward Snowden. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fine.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And it's a little odd in a way to be covering this story every day, which I have been, particularly after the president sort of tried to brush it aside and say, you know, he doesn't want to scramble the jets over a 29-year-old hacker. But that's pretty much what happened yesterday. They didn't scramble the jets, but they grounded the flight of the president of Bolivia looking for Edward Snowden. And of course, this is a day, Bruce, where there's been a coup by the military in Egypt and their two-year-old democracy is now on hold. So why is Edward Snowden so important?
Precisely for the reasons that he stated when he was in Hong Kong with Glenn Greenwald. What his disclosure showed was that our government, the National Security Agency, under a truly Orwellian interpretation of a provision of the Patriot Act, was gathering data about every single phone call in the United States between American citizens on the quite harrowing theory that everything is relevant to a terrorist investigation because we're all candidates to participate in terrorism. We're all suspects. Which is turning the Fourth Amendment on its head. And I want to pause a little bit on the Fourth Amendment because it prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures and ordinarily requires a judicial warrant before you intercept a conversation or search a home, search someone's body for evidence of crime or a weapon or something like that. Probable cause to believe that crime is afoot, some wrongdoing is there. And it was the issue of general writs of assistance that the British were employing to try to detect smuggling that was the spark that led to the American Revolution. And these general writs would enable petty officers to come and rummage through any home looking for what they thought was contraband or items that may have been smuggled. And that was the rallying cry before no taxation without representation that culminated in 1776 and a day tomorrow, which we will celebrate. The right to be left alone from government without probable cause, the most cherished right amongst civilized people. And if we have a little bit of time, let me recite to you the spirit of the Fourth Amendment that was captured by William Pitt the Elder is speaking to the British Parliament in 1763, which I say laid the spiritual cornerstone of the provision. And he said, "The poorest man in his cottage may bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, the roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storms may enter, the rains may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All the forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement." And that was the kind of robust spirit that is the cornerstone of the Fourth Amendment. We have a right to be left alone just because we're human beings. The government must justify encroaching on that right. Part of it is to preserve spontaneity, but part of it is simply to enable what we would call that area of freedom and space that is a crucial part of our happiness, of our contentment. And that has now been turned on its head. It's like, oh, if you don't have anything to hide, you know, you should live in a fishbowl. Well, if you want to volunteer to live in a fishbowl, that's one thing. But the government doesn't get to tell us, you know, that we have to live in a fishbowl. In a republic, the people censure the government. The government doesn't censure the people. And we not only have this revelation, Ian, of this massive seven-year what we call suspicionless spying on Americans, but we have it concealed by statements from the highest levels. For example, our Director of National Intelligence telling one of the senators on the Intelligence Committee, Ron Wyden, in response to a question, "Sir, are you collecting data on Americans?" And he answers, "No," you know, a lie of Pinocchio proportions. And not only that, is he apologetic? No, he says, well, it was the least untruth that I could communicate. Least untruth, I mean, that's going back to the meaning of the word is. And not only that, Ian, the President of the United States who appoints this individual has no words of rebuke, no words of chastisement. You have to be honest. In a government by the people, of the people, for the people, they need to know what government is doing. Nothing. Just what you pointed out, a denigration of Mr. Snowden as well, you know, a hacker. No, he's not a hacker. He was, I called in my letter, he's the Paul Revere of modern day, summoning the American people to confront an approaching a tyranny. If the government knows everything that we do from sun up to sundown, and you can manipulate, you know, anybody who knows how you can manipulate what you find off of the internet, any background information to paint anyone in a poor light, charge them with crime, even if they are ultimately acquitted, then we no longer have a free society. And this encroachment continues day after day. And although it seems a little bit removed from what we're discussing, even the forcing of the Bolivian of the plane that was carrying the Bolivian president down in Europe is an earmark of our arrogance. It's an earmark of, well, we get to decide where planes can fly anytime we have any suspicion, substantiated or not. We get to use our force and defy international conventions. And that's with the Predator drone program. We can invade every country's sovereignty in the world, but they can't invade ours, double standards. And I say that's an arrogance that ultimately brings to ruination every empire. But going back, Edward Snowden disclosed, you know, these things that flout fundamental cornerstones of American democracy. And that's what the conversation needs to be about. And it's shocking to me that members of Congress who are duty-bound to make these disclosures when they know seem to be the most vocal in denouncing him. I mean, we have Senator Dianne Feinstein out in California calling him a traitor. aside from the fact that treason is defined as levying war against the United States in the Constitution, she is the one that has been, in a colloquial sense, a traitor to her obligations, which was she knew about these. She had the speech or debate clause of Article 1, Section 6 for 7 years, which, by the way, gives members an absolute right to disclose classified information in the course of their legislative duties, and did nothing. If you may recall, Ian, Senator Mike Gravel read 47 classified volumes of the Pentagon Papers into the public record, and he was totally exonerated by the Supreme Court, said the Nixon administration can investigate you for espionage because you are protected. The purpose of this constitutional provision is to embolden members of Congress to confront executive abuses and not be shy about disclosure.
Well, also, Bruce, you know, just as a footnote, the Pentagon Papers were an internal document generated by the government to look back on the whole sorry history of Vietnam to get an historical perspective and a historical lesson. If ever there was a document that the American people deserved to have, it was that historical document.
Well, that's right. And to some degree, but it seems to me you could equally say, don't the American people equally have a right to know if the government is spying on them, collecting data on every single phone call? Because with that information, then the American people say, we don't want that to happen. They can then exert the pressure on Congress to change the law. And if we go back and consider a parallel case in recent history, you remember under the Bush administration, the terrorist surveillance program began. This was an executive unilateral decision to deploy the National Security Agency without warrants to capture phone calls and emails of American citizens. And it seemed to be clearly in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but it flourished for years until it was disclosed by the New York Times in December of 2005. After the disclosure, Ian, I testified in some of these hearings, there was a new law passed that curtailed and prevented the warrantless surveillance by the NSA. And that shows how democracy is supposed to function. And that's the same kind of, you know, furtiveness, if you will, secret law that's at issue in this case. It's just not Bush, it's now Obama running a secret program, a total distortion of what you could possibly call the Patriot Act authorized, which required a nexus to any interception with a terrorist investigation. Say, unless you believe every American is a terrorist, the whole thing was way beyond any conceivably a sound argument of what the Patriot Act authorized. And now that it has been disclosed, we already have movement afoot in Congress through a bill introduced by Senator Pat Lay of Vermont that would curtail the abuses that now have surfaced through Edward Snowden's disclosures. He basically was forced to perform the surrogate role of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, as well as Mr. Clapper, who had an obligation to explain exactly what he was doing and why.
Well, Bruce Fine, again, is a constitutional lawyer, formerly Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. His latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He's been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and is currently legal counsel for Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father. He has written an open letter to Edward Snowden. Now, how do you and your client, Lon Snowden, Edward's father, communicate? We don't even know where he is.
Well, we don't have any greater insight than you do, but I received a call, Ian, last Saturday from Julian Assange, and he explained that he wanted to pass on information through me from Edward Snowden to his father, and he related various pieces of information and then identified what I would call an intercessor that we should utilize if we wished to respond. And we have attempted to go through the intercessor on two occasions, and we still don't know for certain whether our communication received Edward Snowden. It seemed a little bit odd to us that if Edward Snowden can communicate with Julian Assange in the Ecuador embassy, that he can't communicate directly with his father. But be that as it may, at present we only have an indirect link that we don't know whether it in fact works. We're working to get a direct link because the father, Lon, is very insistent that until he hears his son's voice, he won't believe the authenticity of any characterization of what his current sentiments are.
But my understanding is that Lon Snowden, Edward's father, wants him to come home, doesn't he?
Well, this is, if you want to talk about this in when confronting the delicacy of psychology here, I think the fact is that Lon respects his son's adulthood, and the son, he says he's got to decide for himself, and he doesn't want to be in a position where he makes a decision less likely because it makes it appear that he's a school marm lecturing somebody. So it has to be very delicately phrased here. I think that it is we have basically said that insofar as the objective of the disclosures was to get the American people, I say summon them like Paul Revere, to an impending tyranny unless something is taken to reduce the Leviathan encroachment on our daily lives, that at present all of that has been deflected by a preoccupation of asylum, and that that is an odd way to consider how the American people can be called to come to the battle about protecting their liberties. And we respect Mr. Snowden. I think none of us can put ourselves in his shoes, but we certainly can comment that the current frenzy about where he may go is a total defeat of his objective, which he stated in Hong Kong to Glenn Greenwald, was to do something for the American people so they would not lose their liberty, they would not be subject to secret law, and he was willing to take the highest risk and even confront what he described as the greatest power in the world that was doomed, in his own words, to catch him in order to advance this higher cause. And that is not at all being aided by the current seeming flirtation with asylum.
But the fact that Julian Assange called you and gave you the means to contact, or gave Edward Snowden's father the means to contact his son, and neither of you or your client, Lon Snowden, are quite sure about whether it's working or not, it does indicate that WikiLeaks seems to be pretty much in control of the situation, at least in terms of access to Edward Snowden.
I think that's a very fair inference, Ian. And I would also call this, you know, to your attention, the audience. The protracted interview that Edward Snowden gave to Glenn Greenwald was bereft of any allusion to asylum. Its preoccupation was with his conscience, what he felt was necessary if he wanted to vindicate, you know, the highest values of the United States Constitution. Not a syllable about asylum. Then if you jump forward to the statement that purportedly was released from Moscow by Edward Snowden, I think on Monday, it's all filled, 90% is asylum and blocking his ability to seek asylum. There's nothing about the Fourth Amendment. There's nothing about secret law. There's nothing about the United States Constitution. And you have to ask, well, what happened here? You know, why did the issue that was the locomotive get removed to the caboose, and the caboose is now the locomotive? And at least a logical inference would be, well, because WikiLeaks wrote that, or the majority of it, not Edward Snowden. Again, this is conjecture. I can't say that for certain. And moreover, the release of the statement identifies or puts in tandem, you know, Bradley Manning with Thomas Drake, and people who know the background of two cases would suggest a little bit like, I don't want to overstate it, you have God and Mephistopheles, you know, paired with one another. And they would indicate a total lack of understanding of the United States system in the background. And they say, Julian Assange has never said anything about the Fourth Amendment, never said anything about the United States Constitution, never basically said anything about all the reasons that Edward Snowden gave to Glenn Greenwald as to why he did what he did. And that reinforces the idea that that particular statement was drafted in whole or in part by WikiLeaks.
Indeed, I had Scott Horton on yesterday who made that same point. But the point that you're making, Bruce Fine, both in this interview and in the letter that you sent to an open letter to Edward Snowden on behalf of yourself and your client, Edward Snowden's father, Lon, you mentioned Clapper. I mean, my sense is that Clapper and General Hayden and all of these people should be put on trial to answer the questions that come out of the Snowden case, and that is this privatization of intelligence, how much the billions and billions of dollars. I mean, you mentioned Thomas Drake. He was a genuine whistleblower who went public about $8 billion of your and my money being wasted by the National Security Agency, and they threw the book at him and treated him like a criminal. So that is, to me, is a big part of this story. So in every sense, we need some clarity here. We need to stop this hypocrisy. If Clapper can lie to the Congress and General Cartwright, who is apparently Obama's favorite general, can leak information to the press, and we know that most of half the newspapers every day are filled with government leaks. So the government has a double standard. It's okay if they leak it through the front door, but heavens forbid that somebody leaks it through the back door.
Well, I agree with everything you said, Ian. The first issue, yeah, it's Clapper and it's Hayden, and it's, you know, the basic rule in Washington: follow the money. These guys now have a vested interest in inflating danger, because then they get more and more contracts. It expands more and more power. So, you justify everything because you make it appear as though terrorism is around the corner, even though your likelihood of dying from terrorism is less than dying because a vending machine fell on you, and that's been calculated. Why is this? Because the money and the power follows, and that's what needs to be exposed. You know, all this staggering sums, and then they invent, oh, well, we foiled all these different terrorist plots, but we can't tell you about any of them, you know? And then you look at them with heightened scrutiny, and they all fall apart. And this is typically what happens. The same thing with the terrorist surveillance program. The inspector general of the CIA did an examination. They said they couldn't find over the years that it foiled a single terrorist plot. That couldn't have been foiled by the ordinary use of the criminal justice process and investigative resources. And it is. It's the money. And the money is now, in my judgment, it's compromising, you know, an intelligent foreign policy. It's compromising intelligent debate, because you have people going in and out of government, all claiming to have the credentials of having served XYZ, and then you talk to them because now they're serving at some executive position at Booz Hamilton or many of these other defense contractors. They all say the same thing. Oh, yeah, we're about ready to die from the attack from the Contiki boats of Al-Qaeda, and we have to keep climbing our expenditures. The danger never ends, and we're in perpetual warfare. And that's what the Congress was assigned to expose. But, Ian, what you've suggested is not going to happen unless Congress gets a vertebrae. I mean, right now I call it the invertebrate branch. They know and do nothing, and it's truly shameful. It's doubly shameful because the Constitution of the United States endowed them with this special privilege, the speech or debate, so they would not be intimidated. They could do things without fear of being hauled before a grand jury. And what do we have here? Silence. You know, the last person who did something was Mike Gravel, and you pointed out it was constructive, but that was 1972, which is how many years ago? You know, over 40 years ago.
Well, just in closing, Bruce Fine, tomorrow being the 4th of July, a lot of apologists for the abuse of the Fourth Amendment suggest, well, you know, technology's changed everything, and we know that Google and Facebook have all kinds of information on us, as well as the National Security Agency, and we know that drones can fly overhead with infrared and look inside your house, and in terms of your person and papers under the Fourth Amendment, it looks as though it's been shredded. What's your sense in terms of how we can restore the original intent of the Founding Fathers in terms of both the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment, because there's so much information out there that can be used against you? The Fifth Amendment is equally under attack as the Fourth.
Yes. Things have to change culturally. You know, we talk about the law, but the law basically follows what I call the moral deposit of the time. Just think, the 14th Amendment said what it said in 1868, and we had a century of Jim Crow laws that said separate but equal, and white supremacy was consistent with, you know, color blindness. And that was just because the culture was that way. And the real danger is we're raising a new generation that's known nothing but this absolute government encroachment and spying on everybody for any reason whatsoever. And it seems to me quite different for Google or Yahoo or whatever to have information, because they want to make money. but they don't necessarily want to deprive you of your liberty. The dangers of government are far greater because they have political motivations to use the information against you, and their goal is to entrench themselves in power, which is obnoxious as some of the stuff that Google can do. It isn't the heart of who we are as a nation. Now, how does this ultimately get changed? I mean, we need a wholesale revision, in my judgment, of civics and how it's taught. We need people to be encouraged to participate, to say it's your duty as a citizen. You've got to protest these encroachments on your rights, stand up, and not have creature comforts trumpet, you know, the dignity that you have in charting your own destiny and pursuing virtue and knowledge as opposed to, you know, the leisurely time of someone who really has no stresses in life. I know it sounds a little bit, some people might call it utopian, but the fact is, without that change, if the culture just accepts this as being inevitable, we will then confront the same ruination of every empire since Genghis Khan and even as far back as the Athenians that Thucydides describes in the Peloponnesian Wars. And it may be a large challenge, but it's up to us. You know, we chart our own destiny.
Well, Bruce Fine, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel to the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director of the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and is currently legal counsel for Lon Snowden, Edward Snowden's father, and he has just written an open letter to Edward Snowden. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a former CIA officer who had the book thrown at him.
I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. See, come see, remember me.
Hey, daddy, all my movie love. You said it would last, but I guess we grow in 1984.
My name is Big Brother. You say that you watching me on the telly. See me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frank Snapp, a Peabody Award-winning investigative journalist, most recently for KNBC in Los Angeles, and the author of two CIA memoirs, Decent Interval, an account of the fall of Saigon based on his perspective as the CIA's chief strategy analyst there, and Irreparable Harm, the inside story of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Snapp, that defines the legal rights and risks of U.S. intelligence employees who become whistleblowers in national security cases. As a result of the CIA winning a court verdict against Snapp, he must clear his writing through the CIA. His latest article at CNN is Snowden and a Muzzled Free Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Snapp.
Good afternoon, Ian.
And Frank, I don't know whether you have any comments on Bruce Fine, who's representing Lon Snowden, who's trying to communicate with Edward Snowden and having to do so through WikiLeaks. And they feel that WikiLeaks is actually speaking for Snowden now. But he did, Bruce Fine really did slam the Congress. And in your piece in CNN, you're suggesting that the Congress making these grandstanding about Snowden being a threat and anybody in the press who publishes what he says is equally guilty of being traitors, et cetera. So the Congress, rather than dealing with what Snowden has told us about, they seem to be jumping on the bandwagon of hunting him down and bringing him back in shackles.
Well, you know, this controversy brings out hypocrisy on all sides. Your previous guest, I believe, served the Reagan administration, which was the first administration actually to prosecute a U.S. official under the espionage charges, the laws, simply for leaking to the press, and they won a conviction. It was the first time it had ever been done. So spare me his indignation. We are, in fairness, dealing with issues we've never confronted before. We're dealing with the most highly classified intelligence in the intelligence lexicon, communications intelligence. There are special laws that cover it. And the damage its exposure can bring is beyond calculation. We have no idea. It can also do a great deal of damage in the wrong hands, and that's what Snowden is talking about. We are also in a situation where irony is the only way to describe the way the oversight process is running. Yes, there is a FISA court, that's a secret court erected to police the NSA, and it makes its deliberations in secret, and the only way we can learn about them is through leaks. That doesn't sound very reassuring. And Congress has acted like Congress, which is it sort of stood back in the face of national security plaints from time immemorial and never been willing to inject itself. That was true of the case I was involved in, which made its way all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and by the way, is the only U.S. Supreme Court decision which bears on the kind of civil liabilities Snowden would face. And I can tell you, when that my case was going forward, nobody in Congress stepped forward to ask that the brakes be put on. The U.S. government was espousing theories which could extend to the press as well as to errant whistleblowers from the CIA. So chaos reigned. And when chaos reigns, then leaks rain down. And nobody performs very well. Let's start with what I wrote about, and then if we can sort of back into some of the issues that Mr. Fine and you were talking about. First off, there are three sets of laws which can be used against Snowden, and one set of them, or I should say two, directly threaten the press. And that's one of the things, I'm a journalist as well as a former whistleblower, former CIA agent, and I deal with classified sources, with classified information, and with covert sources all the time in my reporting. I'm reaching a situation now because of what's happening in the Snowden case where I could be prosecuted for allegedly conspiring with a source to leak classified information. That's really the terrible new development that we're seeing coming out of the Snowden situation. The espionage acts, it turns out, are not very precisely written. And they are elastic enough to cover not only the perpetrator, the leaker, or a spy, but to anyone who conspires with him to disseminate information without the government's approval. And that conspiring is what brings the press into play and exposes the press potentially to sanctions. The communications statute, which is one of those that figures in the criminal complaint against Snowden, makes it possible to punish disclosures that are merely prejudicial to the U.S. interest, not disclosures that do great damage, but that are merely prejudicial. Well, any clever prosecutor could claim that news gathering or a story based on aggressive news gathering is prejudicial. Unless your listeners believe that this is all hypothetical baloney, one should realize that Eric Holder and this liberal progressive administration is pursuing a line of legal logic right now with respect to the press, with respect to other leak cases, that would wind up seeing journalists prosecuted for conspiring to commit journalism if their source was engaging in unauthorized disclosures. My case, which came out of civil law and which was endorsed, or the government's position was endorsed by the U.S. Supreme Court, basically means that if you're a leaker or an associate of a leaker, like a publisher or like the press, you can be bankrupted and you can be gagged without even the government proving that you have leaked secrets, that you are an Edward Snowden or an Edward Snowden accomplice, that you're Glenn Greenwald, what have you. The only thing they have to do is to show that you assisted your source in breaching a non-disclosure agreement. They don't have to prove that, by the way, you've leaked secrets or there is anything classified about your handouts. The only thing they need to do to set you up for prosecution is to show that you broke a non-disclosure agreement or that you assisted someone in doing so. And what that means is the First Amendment is dissolving as protection for all of us, for journalists, for the average citizen who may feel compelled to echo Edward Snowden's disclosures. And so that's all of these developments are in the works. And we're, as I say, we're in a situation now, and this has been developing prior to the Snowden case, because this administration has been looking for ways really to go after Julian Assange. And if they can make it appear that Julian Assange, by receiving Bradley Manning's handouts, he's the Army private who's on trial now for espionage, but if they can show that Assange conspired to elicit those disclosures, then Assange will be set up for an espionage prosecution under the conspiracy theory of espionage, that he conspired in these breaches. So what has happened is that the Snowden crisis, this leak fest, has brought what was a smoldering development, a threat to the press, into full flame. And one of the reasons I wrote about it is because my experience as a whistleblower turned focus of Supreme Court ire. I've learned about a lot of this. I've learned it firsthand. My attorneys include some of the best First Amendment national security specialists in the country, from Alan Dershowitz, Floyd Abrams, you name it. I sat at their knee during my litigation, and I learned where we were going, and that was back in the 1980s. And what I see now happening is a burgeoning threat to the press because of concern over leakers like Snowden and Bradley Manning and their co-conspirators, if you will, like Assange. We're seeing a threat to develop to the mainstream press, and that's almost as terrifying as some of the things that Snowden is talking about.
Sure, and the mainstream press are largely oblivious to this threat. Again, Frank Snapp, Peabody Award-winning investigative journalist, most recently for KNBC in Los Angeles, is the author of two CIA memoirs, Decent Interval, An Account of the Fall of Saigon, based on his perspective as the CIA's chief strategy analyst there, and Irreparable Harm, the inside story of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Snapp, that defines the legal rights and risks of U.S. intelligence employees who become whistleblowers in national security cases. As a result of the CIA winning a court verdict against Snapp, he must clear his writings through the CIA, and his latest article at CNN is Snowden and a Muzzled Free Press. And you've all, in your article, of course, you talk about how the ruling against U.S. versus Snapp, is a ticking time bomb, and the time bomb kept ticking, and several years ago it exploded in the CBS case, where the tobacco company leaned on CBS not to to run a 60 Minutes interview with Jeffrey Wigand, a whistleblower from the tobacco industry, that was going to finally tell the public the truth about how the tobacco industry had been lying for decades about the hazards of nicotine. CBS folded in that case. But your broader point is that now, under these the Espionage Act and the way that they're going after Snowden, there is a contagious liability that could be passed on to journalists. So to my point that it doesn't seem like the press, the mainstream press, recognized the iceberg in front of this Titanic that we're on.
Yes, that's true. And just to give you an idea how the case you're talking about, the Wigan case, figures in the present context, don't forget that Snowden and Manning signed non-disclosure agreements, many of them, in fact, with various government agencies, particularly Snowden. And that means in the present situation, let's say Booz Allen, which was the contractor which hired Snowden in its latest government iteration. It's a consultant for the NSA. That's where he picked up all the secrets he's leaked, or at least the documentation for them. But let's say they decide that Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian or the Washington Post reporter who participated also in breaking the Snowden story, that they assisted Snowden in breaching the non-disclosure agreements that he had signed with Booz Allison, Hamilton. What lawyers for Booz Hamilton could do is to get their lawyers to go in and threaten to sue the Post or the Guardian for continuing to cover the Snowden story. And what happened in the case you were discussing was that the cigarette manufacturer did exactly that with CBS, and CBS, 60 Minutes, folded. What would happen if Booz Hamilton decided to make the same threat against the teetering Guardian or even newspapers that are less robust that recycled Glenn Greenwald's disclosures based on the Snowden leaks? You can see how the dominoes could begin to topple and how Booz Hamilton could begin to generate a threat to the coverage of this story, all because Snowden signed non-disclosure agreements whose strictures extend to people who assist him in breaching those agreements. So that's a very scary process, and that's one of the reasons the Supreme Court decision is so daunting. Just to make it even crazier for your listener, there's a great spy show on the air called The Americans. The producer, writer on that show, is a former CIA agent. He has to clear all of his scripts with the CIA. That's how just off the charts our anti-leak hysteria has become. And where some seeing it come to full focus in the Snowden affair.
Well, Frank, it feels to me, though, that in your case, you know, it was like the establishment came down on you. You didn't release any secrets, but they were just offended by what you'd done, and they threw the book at you. And
well, you know, Ian, let me interrupt, because that's not really what happened. What happened then is what's happened now. My case reached the U.S. Supreme Court amidst the hysteria of the Iran hostage crisis and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Everybody was terrified, howling about the threats to national security. The same thing has happened in the wake of 9/11, and this kind of environment is very bad for robust government oversight and for sensible court decisions. What happens is the watchdogs become timid puppies, and they basically kowtow to anyone who has the right dog whistle.
Right.
That's what happens when the empresarios of our espionage empire go before Congress and say, oh, my God, we won't be able to prevent another 9/11. Then you have Dianne Feinstein and all the rest of them quivering in their slippers or shoes, unwilling to intrude on the oversight, or I should say the intelligence process. And the crazy thing, again, to go back to the Secret Court, which whose authority was expanded in 2008 with an amendment to the Patriot Act, basically gives the overseers cover, because they can say, well, you know, even though we don't know how that court's ruled, it did rule, and therefore what the NSA is doing is court-sanctioned. We are in a Orwellian world when it comes to oversight and management of the intelligence community.
Well, Frank, what I was meaning to say was about the establishment is that, for example, the revelations from Snowden about the spying on the EU and the Europeans and the outrage that's been expressed in Europe flies against the logic that the same European countries that allegedly outraged by what happened are the same ones that stopped Evo Morales' plane. So the feeling that I get is that there's a kind of establishment out there that wants to keep the secrets and they'll do anything to silence whistleblowers.
Yeah, but Ian, there's an establishment on each side of this debate.
Right.
I mean, look.
We've got about a minute here. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I was simply going to say, one of the things that troubles me about Snowden is that he didn't do what a whistleblower did.
That's true.
He didn't do what Dan Ellsberg did or what I did. I went to all the authorities and said, look, help out. I'm going to go public, exactly what Ellsberg did. Right. And when the hammer came down, Ellsberg surrendered himself to authorities. I submitted to the judgment of the courts because I believe that's what you do in a democracy. You take your lumps. The problem with Snowden is he's Roger Rabbit, and he's beating a hasty retreat. He should come back to the United States if he wants to make a moral, ethical case for the arguments he has set forward. He's got to do it by putting his own freedom on the line. That's what whistleblowing is all about. He hasn't gone through that hoop.
Well, Frank Snapper, I thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Snapper, a Peabody Award-winning investigative journalist, most recently for KNBC in Los Angeles, and the author of two CIA memoirs, Decent Interval, An Account of the Fall of Saigon, based on his perspective as the CIA's chief strategy analyst there, and Irreparable Harm, the inside story of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus SNEP, that defines the legal rights and risks of U.S. intelligence employees who become whistleblowers in national security cases. As a result of the CIA winning a court verdict against SNEP, he must clear his writings through the CIA. His latest article at CNN is Snowden and a Muzzled Free Press. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Erwin Chemerinsky about his article on the Roberts Court, Justice for Big Business. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. And his books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government Federalism for the 21st Century. And his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. And he had an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Justice for Big Business. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And there's been a lot of articles recently. Robert Reich wrote one, and Adam Liptak in the New York Times, suggesting that Chief Justice Roberts is the leading Republican strategist, if you will. He has a long view in the sense that he struck down the Voting Rights Act, which, like Citizens United, may well end up helping the Republicans in terms of suppressing Democratic votes. At the same time, he reached out to the growing demographics that the Republican Party is alienating, in this case, the LGBT community, with the other rulings. So that's the sort of description of that idea. And of course, they go back to Bush v. Gore and these other examples, like I mentioned, Citizens United. Is it that simple that we could simply have a politician as our Chief Justice?
Every justice is in part a politician, if you mean by that somebody who has a strategy for what they want to accomplish. Every justice has an ideology, a view of what the Constitution should mean. Every justice in any individual case is trying to get 5 votes to be on the winning side. And every justice is also mindful that they're creating precedents and law that's going to last into the future.
So I remember when Alito was being confirmed, I had a conversation with Cass Sunstein, who is now in the White House. And, you know, his wife is now Samantha Power is now the U.N. ambassador, will soon be the U.N. U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And I remember arguing that this guy sounds like yet another conservative, and that I don't understand why nobody questions a candidate's corporatism, and you certainly have in this article that you wrote in Monday's New York Times, and the notion that, to my mind, that the real issues, that the way that I see the conservatives on this court is that they always vote for corporations over consumers, management over labor, the rich over poor, powerful over weak, and just go through the whole lexicon. That seems to be the way it is. Is it that simple?
Yes. Now, I think amidst a flurry of decisions last week about voting rights and marriage equality and affirmative action, all of which are enormously important, there's a tendency to lose sight of a whole other set of cases that are about what you just described. These were the cases where the Supreme Court made it harder for employees to sue over sexual harassment and race discrimination. These were the cases where the Supreme Court made it harder for patients who were injured by generic drugs to sue the makers of those drugs. These are the cases where the courts made it harder for consumers and small businesses to be able to bring claims against big businesses, with the Supreme Court sending them to arbitrations that will never actually happen.
And the case that the American Express versus Italian Colors restaurant on the June 20th ruling that came down, it seems to me that, and as you point out in your article, there has been a long assault on the idea of class actions, and they finally put the nail in the coffin, if you will. And obviously corporations like to get rid of class actions, because, and they like arbitration, because the agreements, the settlements, are much less than they would normally pay. And furthermore, aren't they sealed so that there's no justice for the injustice done to the consumer?
Well, everything you say is right, but it's easiest if we put it in concrete terms. That was a case of an antitrust claim against American Express. The argument was that American Express was leveraging its market power to impose fees on merchants twice as great as any other card. And American Express insisted that these merchants sign an agreement where they would go to arbitration, and it would be individual arbitration, not class arbitration. To prove an antitrust claim costs hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. The penalty, assuming the plaintiff could prove an antitrust violation, is $38,000. No company is going to spend millions of dollars when all they're going to get is $38,000. That's why you need a class action suit. Or there's a case a couple of years ago that involved consumers who were defrauded of $30.22, and the Supreme Court said they couldn't go to arbitration, they couldn't go to court, and they couldn't bring a class-wide arbitration. It had to be an individual arbitration. No one's going to go to arbitration for $30.22. We need class actions for situations like these, where a large number of people each lose a small amount of money.
Well, of course, the court in its Ledbetter versus Goodyear tire decision, that surely should have woken us up to their priorities. And that was an outrageous ruling. And finally, the Congress overturned it, and President Obama signed the law, signed the Lilly Ledbetter law. Of course, that's when he had a majority. Now, it's almost impossible to get anything through the Congress. Again, going back to my argument with Cass Sunstein, where he basically thought Alito was going to be a okay. My God, I mean, when are we going to have real debates in terms of confirmations with future appointees and really ask about corporatism? That's the one area that seems to be off the table in terms of discussions. And look at the consequences of the pro-corporatist Citizens United decision. And by the way, the polls out today indicate that the public are equally upset with the Supreme Court over getting rid of the Voting Rights Act.
First, it was obvious who Samuel Alito was and what he was going to be on the Supreme Court. I actually testified against Alito before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He had been a federal court of appeals judge for 15 years, and while on that court, he's everything that he's now been in his 7.5 years on the United States Supreme Court. He is just as conservative as Scalia and Thomas, and virtually always with them, certainly in all the important cases. Second, I think you're right that it's generally hard to engage people in procedural rulings or technical statutory rulings of the court. So the decisions last week about employment discrimination were about who's a supervisor, or do you have to prove what's called but-for causation? And yet in reality, what these decisions mean is employers are going to win a lot more employment discrimination cases. Victims of sexual harassment are going to find it much harder to win. But since it's about seemingly technical legal doctrines, much harder to engage people and get them to see how what the Supreme Court's done is dramatically favored big business.
So what is the answer to bring the people, the courtroom, the doors that are now closed to the average citizens? What's the answer to having them open up again? This Congress doesn't seem to be doing its job, and we know how gridlocked and dysfunctional it is. What's the answer here, just in the last minute?
Well, all of the decisions that we've talked about that are saving business are the Supreme Court interpreting federal statutes. Congress can change those statutes. This Congress isn't going to, but hopefully people can rally and elect a different Congress. In the longer term, we've got to elect presidents who will put progressives on the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts so we don't have decisions like this.
And, of course, this president can't even get people under the court below the Supreme Court, and we'll see what happens to the three judges, but that's an extraordinary case there, the Court of Appeals.
When President Bush's nominees were being filibustered, Republicans said they were going to eliminate the filibuster to get the nominees through, and the Democrats caved and backed down. Why aren't the Democrats saying the same thing with the Republicans filibustering President Obama's picks? The Democrats should simply say, we're going to do the nuclear option, eliminate the filibuster, unless you back down.
Well, Chairman Mischke, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, and he has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Justice for Big Business. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again tomorrow on the 4th of July with a special 4th of July program at 5 p.m. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline.